Nettleford was with a dozen ships burning toward Ceres Station, and she wasn't entirely certain of him. Souther. Can you send this version to Admiral Souther? Oh no, it's not cleared for release. Avasarala looked at him, her expression empty. Are you clearing it for release?
I am clearing it for release to Admiral Souther. Please send it immediately.
Michael John bobbed a quick nod, tapping with the tips of both pinkies. Avasarala took out her own hand terminal and sent a simple message to Souther. Watch and call me. When she stood, her legs ached. It was good seeing you again, Michael John said, not looking at her. We should all have dinner sometime.
Let's, Avasarala said, and left.
The women's restroom was cold. Avasarala stood at the sink, her palms flat against the granite. She wasn't used to fear or awe. Her life had been about control, talking and bullying and teasing whoever needed it until the world turned the direction she wanted it to. The few times the implacable universe had overwhelmed her, haunted her. An earthquake in Bengal when she'd been a girl. A storm in Egypt that had trapped her and Arjun in their hotel room for 4 days as the food supplies failed. The death of her son. Each one had turned her constant pretense of certainty and pride against her. Left her curled in her bed at night for weeks afterward. Her fingers bent in claws. Her dreams nightmares. This was worse. Before, she could comfort herself with the idea that the universe was empty of intent, that all the terrible things were just the accidental convergences of chance and mindless forces. The death of the Arbogast was something else. It was intentional and inhuman. It was like seeing the face of God and finding no compassion there. Shaking, she pulled up her hand terminal. Arjun answered almost immediately. From the set of his jaw and the softness of his eyes, she knew he had seen some version of the event. And his thought hadn't been for the fate of mankind, but for her. She tried to smile, but it was too much. Tears ran down her cheeks. Arjun sighed gently and looked down.
I love you very much, Avasarala said. Knowing you has let me bear the unbearable.
Arjun grinned. He looked good with wrinkles. He was a more handsome man now that he was older. As if the round-faced, comically earnest boy who'd snuck to her window to read poems in the night had only been waiting to become this.
I love you, and have always loved you. If we are born into new lives, I will love you there.
Avasarala sobbed once, wiped her eyes with the back of her hand and nodded.
All right then, she said.
Back to work?
Back to work. I may be home late.
I'll be here. You can wake me. They were silent for a moment. Then she released the connection. Admiral Souther hadn't called. Ehrenreich hadn't called. Avasarala's mind was leaping around like a terrier attacking a troop transport. She rose to her feet, forced herself to put one foot in front of the other. The simple physical act of walking seemed to clear her head. Little electric carts stood ready to whisk her back to her office, but she ignored them, and by the time she reached it, she was almost calm again. Bobby sat hunched at her desk, the sheer physical bulk of the woman making the furniture seem like something from grade school. Sorin was elsewhere, which was fine. His training wasn't military. So, you're in an entrenched position with a huge threat coming down onto you, right? Avasarala said, sitting down on the edge of Sorin's desk. Say you're on a moon, and some third party has thrown a comet at you. Massive threat. You understand? Bobby looked at her, confused for a moment, and then, with a shrug, played along.
All right, the Marine said. So, why do you choose that moment to pick a fight with your neighbors? Are you just frightened and lashing out? Are you thinking that the other bastards are responsible for the rock? Are you just that stupid?
We're talking about Venus and the fighting in the Jovian system, Bobby said.
It's a pretty fucking thin metaphor, yes, Avasarala said. So, why are you doing it?
Bobby leaned back in her chair, plastic creaking under her. The big woman's eyes narrowed. She opened her mouth once, closed it, frowned, and began again. I'm consolidating power, Bobby said. If I use my resources stopping the comet, then as soon as that threat's gone, I lose. The other guy catches me with my pants down. Bang! If I kick his ass first, then when it's over, I win.
But if you'll cooperate?
Then you have to trust the other guy, Bobby said, shaking her head.
There's a million tons of ice coming that's going to kill you both. Why the hell wouldn't you trust the other guy?
Depends. Is he an Earther? Bobby said. We've got two major military forces in the system, plus whatever the Belters can gin up. That's three sides with a lot of history. When whatever's going to happen on Venus actually happens, someone wants to already have all the cards.
And if both sides, Earth and Mars, are making that same calculation, we're going to spend all our energy getting ready for the war after next.
Yep, Bobby said. And yes, that's how we all lose together. Chapter 24. Prax. Prax sat in his cabin. For sleeping space on a ship, he knew it was large. Spacious, even. Altogether, it was smaller than his bedroom on Ganymede had been. He sat on the gel-filled mattress, the acceleration gravity pressing him down, making his arms and legs feel heavier than they were. He wondered whether the sense of suddenly weighing more, specifically the discontinuous change of space travel, triggered some evolutionary cue for fatigue. The feeling of being pulled to the floor or the bed was so powerfully like the sensation of bone-melting tiredness, it was easy to think that sleeping a little more would fix it, would make things better. Your daughter is probably dead, he said aloud. Waited to see how his body would react. May is probably dead. He didn't start sobbing this time, so that was progress. Ganymede was a day and a half behind him, and already too small to pick out with the naked eye. Jupiter was a dim disk the size of a pinky nail, kicking back the light of a sun that was little more than an extremely bright star. Intellectually, he knew that he was falling sunward, heading in from the Jovian system toward the belt. In a week, the sun would be close to twice the size it was now, and it would still be insignificant. In a context of such immensity, of distances and speed so far above any meaningful human experience, it seemed like nothing should matter. He should be agreeing that he hadn't been there when God made the mountains, whether it meant the ones on Earth or on Ganymede or somewhere farther out in the darkness. He was in a tiny metal and ceramic box that was exchanging matter for energy to throw a half a dozen primates across a vacuum larger than millions of oceans. Compared to that, how could anything matter? Your daughter is probably dead, he said again. And this time the words caught in his throat and started to choke him. It was, he thought, something about the sense of being suddenly safe. On Ganymede, he'd had fear to numb him. Fear and malnutrition and routine and the ability at any moment to move, to do something, even if it was utterly useless. Go check the boards again. Go wait in line at security. Trot along the hallways and see how many new bullet holes pocked them. On the Rocinante, he had to slow down. He had to stop. There was nothing for him to do here but wait out the long, sunward fall to Tycho Station. He couldn't distract himself. There was no station, not even a wounded and dying one, to hunt through. There were only the cabin he'd been given, his hand terminal, a few jumpsuits a half size too big for him, a small box of generic toiletries. That was everything he had left. And there was enough food and clean water that his brain could start working again. Each passing hour felt like waking up a little more. He knew how badly his body and mind had been abused only when he got better. Every time, he felt like this had to be back to normal. And then, not long after, he'd find that, no, there had been more. So he explored himself, probing at the wound at the center of his personal world like pressing the tip of his tongue into a dry socket. "Your daughter," he said through the tears, "is probably dead. But if she isn't, you have to find her." That felt better. Or if not better, at least right. He leaned forward, his hands clasped, and rested his chin. Carefully, he imagined Katoa's body, laid out on its table. When his mind rebelled, trying to think about something, anything else, he brought it back and put May in the boy's place. Quiet, empty, dead. The grief welled up from a place just above his stomach, and he watched it like it was something outside himself. During his time as a graduate student, he had done data collection for a study of Pinus contorta. Of all the varieties of pine to rise off Earth, lodgepole pine had been the most robust in low-G environments. His job had been to collect the fallen cones and burn them for the seeds. In the wild, lodgepole pine wouldn't germinate without fire. The resin in the cones encouraged a hotter fire, even when it meant the death of the parental tree. To get better, it had to get worse. To survive, the plant had to embrace the unsurvivable. He understood that. "May is dead," he said. "You lost her." He didn't have to wait for the idea to stop hurting. It would never stop hurting. But he couldn't let it grow so strong it overwhelmed him. He had the sense of doing himself permanent spiritual damage, but it was the strategy he had. And from what he could tell, it seemed to be working. His hand terminal chimed. The 2-hour block was up. Prax wiped the tears away with the back of his hand, took a deep breath, blew it back out, and stood. 2 hours twice a day, he'd decided, would be enough time in the fire to keep him hard and strong in this new environment of less freedom and more calories. Enough to keep him functional. He washed his face in the communal bathroom, the crew called it the head, and made his way to the galley. The pilot, Alex his name was, stood at the coffee machine, talking to a comm unit on the wall. His skin was darker than Prax's, his thinning hair black, with the first few stray threads of white. His voice had the odd drawl some Martians affected.
"I'm seeing 8% and falling."
The wall unit said something cheerful and obscene. Amos.
"I'm telling you, the seal's cracked," Alex said.
"I've been over it twice," Amos said from the comm.
The pilot took a mug with the word Tachi printed on it from the coffee machine.
"Third time's a charm."
"All right, stand by."
The pilot took one long, lip-smacking sip from the mug, then, noticing Prax, nodded. Prax smiled uncomfortably.
"Feeling better?"
Alex asked.
"Yes, I think so," Prax said. "I don't know."
Alex sat at one of the tables. The design of the room was military, all soft edges and curves to minimize damage if someone was caught out of place by an impact or a sudden maneuver. The food inventory control had a biometric interface that had been disabled. built for high security, but not used that way. The name Rocinante was on the wall in letters as broad as his hand, and someone had added a stencil of a spray of yellow narcissus. It looked desperately out of place, and very appropriate at the same time. When he thought about it that way, it seemed to fit most things about the ship. Her crew, for instance.
You settling in all right? You need anything?
I'm fine, Prak said with a nod. Thank you.
They beat us up pretty good getting out of there. I've been through some ugly patches of sky, but that was right up there.
Prax nodded and took a food packet from the dispenser. It was textured paste, sweet and rich with wheat and honey, and the subterranean tang of baked raisins. Prax sat down before he thought about it, and the pilot seemed to take it as an invitation to continue the conversation.
How long have you been on Ganymede?
Most of my life, Prax said. My family went out when my mother was pregnant. They'd been working on Earth and Luna, saving up to get to the outer planets. They had a short posting on Callisto first.
Belters?
Not exactly. They heard that the contracts were better out past the belt. It was the whole make a better future for your family idea. My father's dream, really. Alex sipped at his coffee.
And so, Praxidiki, they named you after the moon?
They did. Prax said. They were a little embarrassed to find out it was a woman's name. I never minded it, though. My wife, my ex-wife, thought it was endearing. It's probably why she noticed me in the first place, really. It takes something to stand out a little, and you can't swing a dead cat on Ganymede without hitting 5 botany PhDs. Or, well, you couldn't.
The pause was just long enough that Prax knew what was coming, and could steel himself for it.
I heard your daughter went missing, Alex said. I'm sorry about that.
She's probably dead, Prax said, just the way he'd practiced.
It had to do with that lab you all found down there, did it?
I think so. It must have. They took her just before the first incident. Her and several of the others in her group.
Her group?
She has an immune disorder. Myers-Skelton premature immunosenescence. Always has had.
My sister had a brittle bone disorder.
Hard, Alex said.
Is that why they took her?
I assume so, Prax said. Why else would you steal a child like that?
Slave labor or sex trade, Alex said softly. But can't see why you'd pick out kids with a medical condition. It true you saw a protomolecule down there?
Apparently, Prax said. The food bulb was cooling in his hand. He knew he should eat more. He wanted to, as good as it tasted, but something was turning at the back of his mind. He thought this all through before, when he'd been distracted and starving. Now, in this civilized coffin hurtling through the void, all the old familiar thoughts started to touch up against each other. They'd specifically targeted children from May's group. Immunocompromised children. And they'd been working with the protomolecule.
The captain was on Eros, Alex said.
It must have been a loss for him when it happened, Prax said, to have something to say.
No, I don't mean he lived there. He was on the station when it happened. We all were, but he was on it the longest. He actually saw it starting, the initial infected, that.
Really?
Changed him some. I've been flying with him since we were just farting around on this old ice bucket running from Saturn to the belt.
He didn't used to like me, I suspect. Now we're family. It's been a hell of a trip.
Prax took a long pull from his food bulb. Cool, the paste tasted less of wheat and more of honey and raisin. It wasn't as good. He remembered the look of fear on Holden's face when they'd found the dark filaments, the sound of controlled panic in his voice. It made sense now. And, as if summoned by the thought, Holden appeared in the doorway, a formed aluminum case under his arm with electromagnetic plates along the base.
a personal footlocker designed to stay put even under high G. Prax had seen them before, but he'd never needed one. Gravity had been a constant for him until now.
"Captain," Alex said with a vestigial salute, "everything all right?"
"Just moving some things to my bunk," Holden said. The tightness in his voice was unmistakable. Prax had the sudden feeling that he was intruding on something private, but Alex and Holden didn't give any further sign. Holden only moved off down the hall. When he was out of earshot, Alex sighed.
"Trouble?" Prax asked. "Yeah, don't worry. It's not about you. This has been brewing for a while now."
"I'm sorry," Prax said.
"Had to happen. Best to get it over with one way or the other," Alex said.
But there was an unmistakable dread in his voice. Prax felt himself liking the man. The wall terminal chirped and then spoke in Amos's voice.
"What have you got now?"
Alex pulled the terminal close, the articulated arm bending and twisting on complicated joints, then tapped on it with the fingers of one hand while keeping hold of the coffee with the other. The terminal flickered, data sets converting to graphs and tables in real time.
10%, Alex said. "No, 12. We're moving up. What'd you find?"
"Cracked seal," Amos said.
"And yeah, you're very fucking clever. What else we got?"
Alex tapped on the terminal and Holden reappeared from the hallway, now without his case.
"Port sensor array took a hit. Looks like we burned out a few of the leads," Alex said.
"All right," Amos said. "Let's get those bad boys swapped out.
Or maybe we can do something that doesn't involve crawling on the outside of a ship under thrust," Holden said.
"I can get it done, Cap," Amos said.
Even through the tinny wall speaker, he sounded affronted. Holden shook his head.
"One slip and the exhaust cooks you down to component atoms. Let's leave that for the techs on Tycho. Alex, what else have we got?"
"Memory leak in the navigation system. Probably a fried network that grew back wrong," the pilot said. "The cargo bay's still in vacuum. The radio array's as dead as a hammer for no apparent reason. Hand terminals aren't talking. And one of the medical pods is throwing error codes, so don't get sick."
Holden went to the coffee machine, talking over his shoulder as he keyed in his preferences. His cup said Tachi too. Prax realized with a start that they all did. He wondered who or what a Tachi was.
"Does the cargo bay need EVA?"
"Don't know," Alex said. "Let me take a look."
Holden took his coffee mug out of the machine with a little sigh and stroked the brushed metal plates like he was petting a cat. On impulse, Prax cleared his throat.
"Excuse me," he said, "Captain Holden. I was wondering if the radio gets fixed, or there's a tight beam available, if maybe there was a way I could use some time on the communications array."
"We're kind of trying to be quiet right now," Holden said.
"What are you wanting to send?"
"I need to do some research," Prax said.
"The data we got on Ganymede from when they took May, there are images of the woman who was with them, and if I can find what happened to Dr. Strickland, I've been on a security-locked system since the day she went missing. Even if it was just the public access databases and networks, it would be a place to start."
"And it's that, or sit around and stew until we get to Tycho," Holden said. "All right, I'll ask Naomi to get you an access account for the ROSI's network. I don't know if there'll be anything in the OPA files, but you might as well check them, too."
"Really?"
"Sure," Holden said. "They've got a pretty decent face recognition database. It's inside their secure perimeter, so you might need to have one of us make the request."
"And that would be all right? I don't want to get you in trouble with the OPA.
Holden's smile was warm and cheerful.
"Really? Don't worry about that," he said.
"Alex, what have we got?"
"Looks like cargo door's not sealing, which we knew. We may have taken a hit, blown a hole in her. We've got the video feed back up. Hold on."
Holden shifted to peer over Alex's shoulder. Prax took another swallow of his food and gave in to curiosity. An image of a cargo bay no wider than Prax's palm took up one corner of the display. Most of the cargo was on electromagnetic pallets, stuck to the plates nearest the wide bay door, but some had broken loose, pressed by thrust gravity to the floor. It gave the room an unreal, Escher-like appearance. Alex resized the image, zooming in on the cargo door. In one corner, a thick section of metal was bent inward, bright metal showing where the bend had cracked the external layers. A spray of stars showed through the hole.
"Well, at least it ain't subtle," Alex said.
"What hit it?" Holden said.
"Dunno, Cap," Alex said. "No scorching, as far as I can see. But a Gauss round wouldn't have bent the metal in like that. Just would have made a hole. And the bay isn't breached, so whatever did it didn't make a hole in the other side."
The pilot increased the magnification again, looking closely at the edges of the wound. It was true there were no scorch marks, but thin black smudges showed against the metal of the door and the deck. Prax frowned. He opened his mouth to speak, then closed it again. Holden said what Prax had been thinking.
"Alex, is that a handprint?"
"Looks like one, Cap, but pull out. Look at the decking."
They were small, subtle, easy to overlook on the small image. But they were there. A handprint, smeared in something dark that Prax had the strong suspicion had once been red. The unmistakable print of 5 naked toes. A long smear of darkness. The pilot followed the trail.
"That bay's in hard vacuum, right?" Holden asked.
"Has been for a day and a half, sir," Alex said.
The casual air was gone. They were all business now.
"Track right," Holden said.
"Yes, sir."
"Okay, stop. What's that?"
The body was curled into a fetal ball, except where its palms were pressed against the bulkhead. It lay perfectly still, as if they were under high G and it was held against the deck, crushed by its own weight. The flesh was the black of anthracite, and the red of blood. Prax couldn't tell if it had been a man or a woman.
"Alex, do we have a stowaway?"
"Pretty sure that ain't in the cargo manifest, sir.
And did that fellow there bend his way through my ship with his bare hands?"
"Looks like maybe, sir."
"Amos? Naomi?"
"I'm looking at it, too."
Naomi's voice came from the terminal a moment before Amos's low whistle. Prax thought back to the mysterious sounds of violence in the lab, the bodies of guards they hadn't fought, the shattered glass and its black filament. Here was the experiment that had slipped its leash back at the lab. It had fled to the cold, dead surface of Ganymede and waited there until a chance came to escape. Prax felt the goose flesh crawling up his arms.
"Okay," Holden said. "But it's dead, right?"
"I don't think so," Naomi said.
Chapter 25. Bobby. Bobby's hand terminal began playing reveille at 4:30 a.m. local time. What she and her mates might have grumbled and called "Oh Dark 30, back when she'd been a Marine and had mates to grumble with. She'd left her terminal in the living room, lying next to the pull-down cot she used as a bed, the volume set high enough to have left her ears ringing if she'd been in there with it. But Bobby had already been up for an hour. In her cramped bathroom, the sound was only annoying, bouncing around her tiny apartment like radio in a deep well. The echoes were a sonic reminder that she still didn't have much furniture or any wall hangings. It didn't matter. She'd never have a guest. The reveille was a mean-spirited little joke Bobby was playing on herself. The Martian military had formed hundreds of years after trumpets and drums had been a useful means of transmitting information to troops. Martians lacked the nostalgia the UN military had for such things. The first time Bobby had heard a morning reveille, she'd been watching a video on military history. She'd been happy to realize that no matter how annoying the Martian equivalent, a series of atonal electronic blats, was, it would never be as annoying as what the Earth boys woke up to. But now Bobby wasn't a Martian Marine anymore. "I'm not a traitor," Bobby said to her reflection in the mirror. Mirror Bobby looked unconvinced. After the blaring trumpet call's third repetition, her hand terminal beeped once and fell into a sullen silence. She'd been holding her toothbrush for the last half hour. The toothpaste had started to grow a hard skin. She ran it under warm water to soften it back up and started brushing her teeth. "I'm not a traitor," she said to herself, the toothbrush making the words unintelligible. "Not." Not even standing here in the bathroom of her UN-provided apartment, brushing her teeth with UN toothpaste and rinsing the sink with UN-provided water. Not while she clutched her good Martian toothbrush and scrubbed until her gums bled. "Not," she said again, daring Mirror Bobby to disagree. She put the toothbrush back into her small toiletry case, carried it into the living room, and placed it in her duffel. Everything she owned stayed in the duffel. She'd need to move fast when her people called her home, and they would. She'd get a priority dispatch on her terminal, the red and gray border of the MCRN syncom flashing around it. They'd tell her that she needed to return to her unit immediately, that she was still one of them, that she wasn't a traitor for staying. She straightened her uniform, slid her now quiet terminal into her pocket, and checked her hair in the mirror next to the door. It was pulled into a bun so tight it almost gave her a facelift, not one single hair out of place. "I'm not a traitor," she said to the mirror. Front hallway Mirror Bobby seemed more open to this idea than bathroom Mirror Bobby had. "Damn straight," she said, then slammed the door behind her when she left. She hopped on one of the little electric bikes the UN campus made available everywhere and was in the office 3 minutes before 5 a.m. Sorin was already there. No matter what time she came in, Sorin always beat her. Either he slept at his desk or he was spying on her to see what time she set her alarm for each morning. "Bobby," he said, his smile not even pretending to be genuine. Bobby couldn't bring herself to respond, so she just nodded and collapsed into her chair. One glance at the darkened windows in Avasarala's office told her the old lady wasn't in yet. Bobby pulled up her to-do list on the desktop screen. "She had me add a lot of people," Sorin said, referring to the list of people Bobby was supposed to call in her role as Martian military liaison. "She really wants to get a hold of an early draft of the Martian statement on Ganymede. That's your top priority for the day, okay?" "Why?" Bobby said.